I'm Ed the Sock, and this is FU Politics on Fun, the FU Network, powered by your support on Patreon.com/FU Network TV, and through PayPal at FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. And now, here's your show.
Hello, Stephen.
Hello, Stephen. Good to see you, or good to hear you anyway.
Well, metaphorically see me. As we speak, you can picture me in your mind's eye. I don't recommend it, but it is an option. Well, we've got some unfortunate excitement to discuss this week.
Usually, quiet Canada, yeah.
Yeah, usually Canadian news is a snorer, especially when you compare it to what's pouring over the border. You know, as we record this, Trump is pulling the U.S. out of the World Health Organization. We don't have anything that earth-shaking usually going on in Canada, but we did have what appears to be somebody bent on doing harm to the Prime Minister, who crashed his truck through the gates at Rideau Hall and had weapons with him. Some of them are legal, some were illegal, and claimed he just wanted to have a conversation with the Prime Minister. And after a 90-minute conversation with the RCMP, he surrendered, and there were no shots fired, which is, I mean, it's thankfully a very Canadian resolution. Somebody who seemed to be started out bent on violence, driving all the way from Manitoba to Ottawa, winds up talking it out and then getting arrested. That's very Canadian, and I say that in the best sense of very Canadian. Some people seem sad that our news tends to be somewhat boring. And my thought is, you remember how exciting it's been with COVID? You really want excitement all the time?
Yeah, I'm tired of exciting.
I'm glad to go back to boring Canada. But the fact that somebody was motivated to have an armed conversation, let's just say, with the Prime Minister with prohibited weapons, that is a news story. And there's a news story that has sprung from the news story, that being the National Post's sort of almost like written for this individual, almost like an obituary is written, in the sense that it brings up all these salient, heartwarming points about the person's life and humanizes them.
It's like at a funeral where you don't want to say anything bad about someone.
That's right. They discuss this person's history, the things he loves, his service to the military, his
sausage making business.
Yeah, his pride and his fire in the hole sausage or something. Like this is it read like what you read, you know, in the newspapers in an obituary, which is something that is short of glowing, but definitely there to provide a sense of the human being who they're describing. And people have pointed out quite rightly that when the terrorist, and this was terrorism, when the terrorist is somebody who is not white, the news is not really, we don't get articles talking about what a family man they are and how many things they loved and, you know, and humanizing them. In fact, what we tend to get is stuff which dehumanizes them, which, you know, discusses their often, if it's terrorism, their Muslim connections, and dehumanizes them, doesn't try to make you see them as a human being who was troubled, as this article did. It makes you see them as somebody who is trouble. And I would say that this individual who wanted to have an armed conversation with the Prime Minister is definitely trouble and was connected to conspiracy websites and right-wing lunatics and things of that nature. Did we really need to know about his, you know, do we really need a pen to this man? I mean, article, you know, he had, part of reading a bit from the article, he had ambition for Grindhouse, the name of his business, and his Ring of Fire specialty, boasting of having his sausage served inside the Winnipeg Blue Bombers Stadium and tickling the palate of celebrity investor Arlene Dickinson of Dragon's Den fame.
Oh, I wonder if it goes well with a lovely Chablis. Yes.
I mean, honest to God, is this the kind of paragraph we need to see? Is this what we need to know about somebody who tried to ostensibly appears to have had violent intentions on our government leader?
Hitler, a budding art enthusiast who
was a vegetarian and loved dogs.
Yeah, and had a passion for politics.
Yeah, in this case, the gentleman, according to this article, had a passion for cooking meat. You know.
Well, like, there you go. How could that be a bad person then?
And he taught wilderness survival. to people, and you know, all these things that he contributed to, all these positive attributes of this individual's life. Now, if the goal was to show how somebody who has done decent things, or who otherwise can appear to be a well-rounded human, can go off the deep end, you know, as a cautionary tale, well, maybe. But that didn't seem to be the way it was portrayed, and it certainly wasn't the way it was received.
Yeah, and it wasn't just the National Post, which you expect to be, you know, not a fan of Trudeau, but you know, the CBC as well wrote their initial coverage of it was this a similar kind of puff piece about this sausage maker who had suffered losses in his business and was another victim of COVID-19 in the economy, and it's important to understand people's motivation. It's important to understand their backgrounds, because everyone's curious about, like, how does this happen? What's this person thinking? And it, you know, it's important not to demonize people as well, because it's so easy just to dismiss someone who does something terrible as crazy, as a demon, as evil, as whatever, because that makes us feel better about ourselves, because it others them. It says, like, this could never happen to me because this person is just plain evil. He's possessed by the devil or whatever else. So it's important to understand people's background. But the way that it was initially presented, like you said, they led with all of this stuff. You know, the headlines were like, troubled sausage maker wants to talk to prime minister. Or, you know, or you just have to go back and read some of the clips. And it really was, I don't know who was on the copy editor's desk that day, but, you know, like you said, this person was a terrorist, showed up with 4 guns,
and a rapid loading clip.
Yeah,
he had
a high capacity magazine, which was prohibited for his M14. And I don't know if you've ever seen. I actually posted on my Twitter thing just a little clip. And your arm goes, oh, an M14. What's that like? You know, it's a 308, which is a big round. It does incredible amounts of damage. This isn't some pea shooter. This is military grade, high powered weaponry. Which he did own legally, the M14. The high capacity magazine he did not own legally, because those things are just plain illegal.
And two of the guns were prohibited, were illegal.
Yeah, and one of them, you know, the other one was a revolver that he had, and two shotguns. And I can't tell from the description of the charge whether or not some of those shotguns are actually they're not duck hunting shotguns. They're riot control shotguns.
But the shotguns were not prohibited weapons. The other weapons are prohibited weapons.
No, not at all. But some shotguns actually, you know, have take a clip. You know, they look more, you know, they're more for tactical use than they are for duck hunting. But it doesn't matter for killing zombies
in video games.
If you're on the other end of it, it really doesn't matter, because, you know, it'll really ruin your day. But, you know, for this person to be an active member in the Canadian Armed Forces as well at the same time. And there was thought that he was present at the rally that was going on by various disaffected right-wing nuts on the grounds of Parliament earlier that day. And as you said, you know, it's important to understand his motivation. And the thing that, you know, we know a lot about his sausage, but there's only been sort of glancing discussions about sort of what he was on about, what he wanted to talk to Trudeau about. At gunpoint. And, you know, he had a note, and originally someone reported that the note referred to something that was called, a Bill Gates-backed pandemic simulation that the military was part of. And, you know, they do simulations, same way they do war games, do simulations of pandemics as well. And it was called Event 201. And, you know, this is like Agenda 21 with the of the UN and all kinds of other, you know, FEMA camps and all part of that crazy right-wing idea. And the whole idea that this was a bill, you know, that COVID was created by Bill Gates for whatever reason. I don't know. Bill Gates got more money than anything else, but he's pretty sure that it was done by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation and the World Economic Forum, because you know those guys are no good. And he wanted to alert Trudeau, according to some sources, of the origins of the pandemic and, you know, the evilness of having working with Bill Gates.
So well, you don't really need to. Do you really need to take weapons if you really just want to have a conversation? You've got to be understanding that you're going to be engaged in something that will probably be responded to with military force if you're going to take weapons with you. Why doesn't he just send a tweet? You know, do something that will actually attract it. You know, well, it won't attract the prime minister's attention because those kinds of lunatic tweets he gets all the time and are probably weeded out by his people. But I mean, clearly this person was distressed, and to use this as an example of how people have become distressed during COVID-19 due to economic circumstances and where it has led them. And how these right-wing forces are there with open arms, that could be a cautionary tale that could be of value. I think also if we had a responsible opposition, they would look at this and say, oh, look what our rhetoric is helping to inspire. Look what our constant barrage of anti-Trudeau rhetoric is inspiring. Because they're not anti-government. They're not the opposition to the government at this point, the Conservatives. They're just opposition to Trudeau. There is something knee-jerk in them that they just hate Trudeau, and they go after him personally. They're not really going after government policy, government programs, as much as they're going after the person of Justin Trudeau. They are fomenting a real hatred of this person, of this Justin Trudeau, and it is leading to crazies like this blaming things on Trudeau that are not his fault. And you would think that if this would be a moment for them to get sober and say, okay, look, we really need to look at our rhetoric. We really need to look at our strategy. We're not gaining in the polls as a result of it. And it looks like we are feeding into some people who have very nefarious purposes and some people who are emotionally or psychologically at their breaking point. And we are focusing their attention or telling them that the person to blame is Justin Trudeau. If they were responsible, they would stop and take a look at what kind of effect their rhetoric is having. But if they were responsible, they wouldn't be doing that kind of rhetoric. It's common for the opposition to take shots at the prime minister, but this is beyond the pale. They just have an intrinsic hatred of Justin Trudeau as a person and as an idea. And they go after him personally all the time and try to point out personal foibles, whereas their job is really to point out errors in governing or
in government policy.
Exactly. Yeah, places where government policy is either wrong or could be reshaped to avoid certain potential problems or pitfalls that they see. That's helping the Canadian population. The way the Conservatives have carried on as the opposition, they're really only trying to serve themselves. They're not serving all of Canada by trying to point out weaknesses in policy or so on, or providing policy alternatives. They're just trying to serve their base to try to build up for the next election. And they're doing it so poorly that the Conservatives keep dropping in the polls, Liberals keep rising.
Yeah. Now, I'm going to ask you, because I haven't seen this up until a little while ago. I haven't seen any kind of condemnation statement, or even statement of sympathy from Scheer over the Rideau Hall attack. I've seen nothing from Scheer. I've seen nothing from McKay. I've seen nothing from O'Toole. I checked just for fun. I looked at the Rebel News site to see if they even mentioned it, just to see what they said. And there's not a word about it in there. And so it kind of continues what you were saying about this antagonistic environment that they thrive on, which is their meat and potatoes, to the extent where they can't even say, this is pretty terrible. Canada, but it hits so many points. I mean, you got a legal gun owner. He had illegal guns too, but he was a legal gun owner. He owned his M14 legally, and the shot. I don't know, but shotguns you don't need a license to buy. But the M14 is on the new list, but it's grandfathered. But he had it before it, so he had somebody who was a gun person say, well, no, having that high capacity magazine, which is prohibited, and he didn't have a license for that. That makes him an illegal gun owner. say, well, you know, every, except for the guy who buys it out of the trunk of a car, every gun owner that ends up using their gun for an illegal manner ends up being an illegal gun owner, but they started off being a legal one. So he obtained one legally. And that was the one actually he was carrying around the Rose Garden of Rideau Hall. It wasn't the shotguns. It was the one that he legally had. Now he was transporting it illegally and all kinds of other stuff, but he still had it legally. But the conservatives, they don't want to touch that issue because there's guns involved. Like you say, it's he's a person who's mad at Trudeau over the economy, and you know they don't want to call him out on that because they're all open the economy kinds of people. And guys from Manitoba, he's from the West. There's all kinds of reasons why their base would be very unhappy if they showed the slightest amount of sympathy, which I think is just common decency to condemn this kind of this kind of shocking thing.
Well, I mean, I was scanning the internet myself, trying to find, maybe I was using the wrong keywords, but myself trying to find any condemnation or words of support, as you mentioned, condemnation for the act of this individual or support for the Prime Minister from Andrew Scheer, and I found nothing. Now, again, I could be using the wrong keywords. And another noteworthy difference between this individual and his terrorist act and a terrorist act committed by a person of color is that a local radio show host where this individual lives started a GoFundMe campaign for the guy's family.
Yeah.
When have we ever seen any kind of sympathy for the family of a terrorist who is a person of color? Instead what we see is people blaming the family, and putting a jaundiced eye towards the family as if they themselves must harbor some terrorist sympathies. If this person who was a member of their family turned out to be a terrorist, they must have fed into it. They must have encouraged it. You know, there's just these automatic assumptions that are made, and the way the press goes after the family, they're holding the family as responsible in some cases as the individual. And yet here we have somebody, a white person from the West, who has managed to inspire a local radio host to start a GoFundMe campaign for the family. They were looking for $1,000. They've raised almost $10,000. At this point in time. And the names of the people contributing are there in the GoFundMe campaign. These people are not shy about saying, yeah, we're going to support the poor family of this person who drove to Ottawa with the intention of an armed conversation with our prime minister. You don't see that unless it's a white person. I mean, I don't know why GoFundMe hasn't shut it down. They do have rules about not raising money for people who are facing criminal action. Or criminal charges. And the person who started this campaign says very clearly that this money is to go to support his wife and kids because they're innocent. They don't deserve, should they really be forced to pay for what it says that the terrorist, he made a poor choice.
Yes, I would say that is a poor choice. Who among us hasn't driven through the gates of Rideau Hall with four guns?
He says, if you have strong feelings that Jennifer and the kids should somehow be left in the cold because of a poor choice her husband made. Mm-hmm. Yeah, poor choice. Talk about soft pedaling what this individual did. It'd be one thing if he actually really condemned what the individual did, but he's just calling it a poor choice?
Sure. Well, I'm sure these are the same people who say that Omar Khadr's father made poor choices bringing him as a child into a war zone. I mean, that's a poor choice.
169 donors, Stephen. 169. Yeah.
Well, like you
donors.
Say, and their names are out there. And the other thing too is if you you look at the comments, because they don't just give money; they also post things. And, I imagine some of it might be getting, some of it's lightly curated from what I saw last time I looked. And also, if you look at some of the other sites out there, there's a lot of laudatory stuff about the actual attempted shooter, saying about, about time someone, stood up for what's right kind of thing. And it's like, I'm hoping the RCMP is taking down a couple of these names just because... They may be they might be the kind of people you want to put on a bit of a watch list because, I'm all for dissent. I'm all for healthy, vigorous debate and disagreement of opinions and all the rest. But, you know, when you're funding terrorism or the family of terrorists, it's a whole different thing. This is, you know, these are people who have been emboldened, like you said, by the rhetoric that came from, the rump of the Conservative Party. Aaron O'Toole is using the same sort of Trumpian language and all of his stuff about taking Canada back and all the rest.
Peter MacKay. Peter MacKay is talking about taking.
Well, he's
Canada
afraid that
back.
Bus is leaving the station, and he needs those delegates. And those are motivated delegates.
Yeah, I mean, this taking Canada back from what? I actually asked somebody that on Twitter, and there was no answer.
Yeah,
because what do we need to take Canada back from? There was a recent international survey, and it found that Canada's competitiveness as an economy is better than the United States for the first time, at least according to their rating. We rate higher than the United States and many other countries, as far as a place to live. Like, we rate in the top 10 all the time as a country to live, based on equity, based on economic freedoms, based on so many different standards. And what is there to take back? What do you want to do to? I mean, we're clearly on the right path. You know, yeah. You can argue here and there about certain policy decisions, but as a country, we're doing all right. And it's one thing to say we're doing okay, but we can do better. That's not the same as saying we need to take Canada back as if it is being run into the ground. And by fomenting those kinds of attitudes, mixed with the intrinsic hatred some people have of the fact of Justin Trudeau, it's creating a tinderbox. And there are people who are saying things like, well, as much as I don't like what he did, this goes to show what happens when the prime minister, blah, 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 blah. Finding justifications and explanations and rationalizations for something that should not be explained and should not be rationalized. It is what it is. He took a violent action in order to see the prime minister. And you don't get to see the prime minister just because you drove your truck from Manitoba. So he very clearly had nefarious intents. Yeah. You don't go places with four guns unless you have nefarious intents. So there should be nobody who is trying to rationalize or explain this person or justify what he's doing to say on one hand, well, what he did was wrong, but it goes to show you how wrong the prime minister is. No, this is not an indictment of the prime minister. And this is not an opportunity to use this as an indictment of the prime minister. This is an indictment of this individual and of the people spreading the rhetoric that feeds into people who are in vulnerable situations emotionally and psychologically and have access to firearms.
Yeah, it provides a trigger. In the United States, it's a much bigger bomb because, everyone's armed down there. But I'm amazed that people don't realize, and I think people are starting to wake up a little bit to this, that the violence is pretty much all on the right. I mean, I'm talking about personal human injuring other human beings, violence. I mean, if you look at, they go on and on about Antifa and the left, and, and the left pull down statues. They have people who follow along behind them and break windows and loot stores. And there are demonstrations, mostly peaceful. Sometimes they get out of hand, but you don't really see the violence, and the numbers bear it out. If you go to any of the domestic terrorist organizations, the number one threat is from the right for violence, for political violence. They resort to killing people. They drive their cars through crowds of people and kill peaceful protesters. They, they crash a car through the gates at Rideau Hall, armed with more guns than you have hands. It's taking right-wing violence seriously is something we really have to do, because the threat isn't from the left. Left makes lots of noises and it's inconvenient sometimes. It shuts down intersections and boycotts businesses, and once in a while, during the aftermath of Black Lives Matter, a lot of windows get broken and some targets get looted in the States and that sort of thing. But that's property. Now, property is important. We all love our property, but you can fix it, you can replace it. But the right kills people, whether it is lynching people, not that long ago, or assassinating people. It is
beating people up.
I mean, the violence is on the right. And I think our security services and our police are starting to twig to it. But the problem is, as they found out in the United States, a lot of those people on the right are actually part of the police and part of the administration. I mean, as someone said, you know, why don't you see in the United States, why don't you see the police at a Klan rally? It's like, well, the same reason you don't see Miley Cyrus and Hannah Montana in the same room. You know, it's because they're the same people a lot of the time.
interesting illusion.
There you go.
But it's disturbing the way that this has been handled, because you know that the right-wing media would be beating the drums for just character assassination, well, not character, accurate character assassination of the terrorist, and would be assassinating the character of their parents and friends by their association with this individual if he was Muslim. But because he's white, there's this attempt to humanize him and make us sympathize with his plight. It's like, no,
just a small businessman who's fallen on tough times. And
yeah, as many have, and who don't go with guns to break into Rideau Hall. There's no excuse for it. There's no rationalizing it. And those who are excusing it and rationalizing it are a part of the problem. And they need to be looked at too, be they individuals or political, quote unquote, leaders. They're leading us down the wrong path. And we should, I'd like to switch gears, still talking about Trudeau, but talking about the controversy over the use of the WE organization to deliver grants to students who volunteered this summer, the money to be used to help them pay their tuition in the fall. Do you want to take us from there? Stephen? Oh, not again.
Here?
Yeah. Well, there you are.
Oh yeah, I'm still here. Yes. Okay. No, I just went out for a cigarette. No, I don't. Oh. I don't even smoke. No. Well, it's a weird story. Let's just start there. You know, the WE organization, you know, is big. It's 25 years old. It's international, and it is a registered charity. So its finances are fairly transparent. I actually looked them up. On there's something called Charity Intelligence, which does sort of ratings of all of the charities, and they before I get into sort of the internal drama of some of their own politics, I mean, in terms of being a charity, according to the most recent full fiscal year they have, this organization gives them an A for results reporting. They have financial transparency, and only 9 cents of every dollar goes to overhead, which is pretty good to the charity.
That was, you know, the 9 cents out of every dollar is small, because there are some charities,
some
charities
are up in the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, and some are higher than that. Some have been found even higher than that. So 9 cents, that's a good ratio.
Yeah, yeah, actually. So, you know, 91 cents go to the cause, according to Charity Intelligence Canada, which is a legitimate, well-respected thing. Now, they also have a sister organization, which is WE to Me, which people kind of confuse the two of them, because the WE to Me often goes into, it's actually a for-profit social enterprise that is separate from the WE charity. And it runs programs and tours, and you know, charges you to take you to Kenya to build schools, or Central America to dig wells, kind of thing. But it sends most of its money to we don't know most, because it's a private company and it doesn't have to report. But it sends about $20 million in cash and donated goods from Me to WE to the WE charity. So it basically is a feeder organization. And this is the one that sometimes you see in schools. You know, the Me to WE, they're very, very, very big in high schools, particularly, you know, doing rallies to, you know, encourage school-age kids to volunteer. They're very big on the requirement now that there be 40 hours of community service for to graduate from high school in Ontario. So, you know, they're involved, but there's controversies too. I mean, there's internal There's internal discussions about the way it's run, mostly, from what you can tell. I mean, it's always hard to tell with an organization, especially mostly volunteer organization. There's a lot of personalities involved. The people who actually began it were you know, you love them or you hate them. They they have a connection to Trudeau, and they, you know, and this is the thing, the conservatives have been going on and on about this being like, oh, this is more corruption. It's like, well, Trudeau, Justin Trudeau volunteered for them. I mean, he's never worked for them, you know, but Trudeau, he was doing Katimovic and all that kind of stuff. And I think he really saw that the Foundation is something that is really very, very akin to kind of his own spirit of volunteerism. So I think he feels a natural affinity for them. And Sophie Gregoire Trudeau has been, she's sort of a celebrity patron and does a podcast, unpaid, for the charity as well, and where she hosts a podcast, you know, much like we're doing right now, and talks about charity. But that's the level of connection between the Trudeaus. So everyone goes on about, oh, you know, this is another cozy insider deal.
Well, you know,
there's no money involved. I mean, Trudeau, like I say, volunteered, but the interesting thing is that this is a program that's supposed to be rolled out this summer. And here we are in the, you know, at the starting the second week of July. It's not a lot of summer left. And the biggest problem, and I kind of understand, although, you know, I say, you can argue about the optics all day. I think the optics are probably a little too close, a little too cozy for a sole-sourced, you know, fairly large government program to be rolled out by a private charity. But to roll something like this out, you look around, you go like, well, what are we going to do? We need a big organization that has a lot of feet on the ground, that can deploy really, really quickly. You know, has a good ratio of overhead to delivering your services, as we just talked about. And otherwise, you're looking at, well, the government has to create a program. All right, well, you got to create committees. You got to create a structure within the government. You got to worry about the Public Service Alliance Union. You've got to mobilize during COVID, so people, you know, are actually going to create a program, create all the, you know, all this infrastructure for it. The government can't move that fast. And then you say, okay, well, we should spread it over 50 different charities and spread the money all around. Well, then you have to coordinate with all 50 charities. You have to make sure that they don't overlap geographically or whatever else, that you're reaching everybody, that you're not leaving anyone behind. There's a vetting process and all the rest for 50 things now instead of one. I can see why they picked one. I think,
well, I see why they picked one. But I don't know why they picked this one, because there are other organizations that are capable of doing all the things that you said. And part of the role of the sole individual organization that's going to get this money and administer it is they then have to go and source out other charity organizations, other public service organizations, because they have to find the placements for these students and where the money's going to go.
Right.
And as I understand it, we does not play well with others, or hasn't played with others, that unlike a lot of other charities which belong to organizations and so on, we stands alone. So they don't actually have the relationships with the service providers that they're going to need in order to, you know, in a speedy fashion, administrate these grants. I understand that there's a problem, and I think that the government blew it in this case, because they would have had to realize that the optics were going to be bad, and you've got a opposition and a media that is slavering for, you know, just drooling for red meat.
Yep.
You really should have ready at, you know, as soon as, before you announce this, you should have ready documents showing how the contract was awarded, why the contract was awarded, what the process was for awarding the contract, all those things that the opposition is asking for, which in my view are fair things to ask for. I'm sorry that it derailed the entire thing and they're now going to try to find somebody else. But there really should have been a crystal ball, so to speak. There should have been something that was transparent that people could look at and say, okay, here's how this has happened. There should be no questions that are left unanswered. And right now, there are questions that are left unanswered. And yep. the government blew it in that way. They were totally off base in predicting what kind of response this would have. Now, generally, people feel that this program should have gone forward, and we, you know, you can investigate how it was moved forward afterwards. But the important thing is getting this program going for kids. But they really, there are questions I want to know the answers to. I'm not willing to give the government a pass on this. I think that for Justin Trudeau to say that WE was the only organization that can deliver this program, I'd like to know why he says that. I'd like to know what data he has that indicates that of all the organizations out there, WE was the only one that could provide what is needed by the government. Because granted, the government can't do this. The government, if they want to start a program like this, they'll strike a committee, and maybe in 7 years, it'll happen. Governments can't move that fast. But I would like to know if Justin Trudeau says unabashedly that WE was the only organization that could deliver it. Well, first of all, then how can he go back and say, well, now someone else is going to do it? But I want to know, what were the criteria by which he was able to, he felt comfortable making that statement? Because I've read a lot of things that indicate that, in fact, WE is not the only company or charitable organization that could do this. But in fact, there are others that may have been able to do it better due to their relationships with the volunteer service organizations that are going to be necessary.
Yeah, and I think you're absolutely right. I think as taxpayers, and I hate to identify myself as a taxpayer because I like to think a much more well-rounded person than that, but I think taxpayers need to know that money's being spent. And it's a lot of money. It was up to $900 million. Whether or not they ever got that depended on how many people they actually signed up and how many volunteer hours were done and all the rest. It wasn't a lump sum. It was that's how much was allocated up to, and it's doubtful they ever would have reached that. But it's still a lot of money, and every time you're spending a lot of money, you need to know. And as Trudeau has said that they are the only ones who could do it, but he also said he was very quickly to say when they separated and when the heat came on that he didn't pick them, that it was picked by the government. It was a recommendation from the government that from the public service, from the civil service, that WE be the one to administer this thing. Whether Trudeau had his thumb on the scale or whether or not that's legit, there must have been paperwork behind it, like you said, that justified it. I'd be curious to see what that is. Of course, the opposition is slavering to see that, and they're already running this as another ethical violation, scandal, whatever. It's the government does outsource all kinds of delivery of important services to Canadians, and a lot of Canadians aren't aware of the fact that the government is a major source of funding for things like the Red Cross, the United Way, and Canada Blood Services, the Canadian National Institute for the Blind, the Salvation Army. They all receive government grants to service the community because the government realizes that they are better at it than some monolithic civil service organization trying to administer. I mean, the government does it through itself, through, well, you know, we've got the CERB, but we have tax credits and the baby bonus and, all kinds of little social payments that are done federally. But the government also gives out pretty hefty amounts to some of these charities to administer, to fill certain areas that the government just, either shouldn't be in or isn't capable of being in. So I'm not so concerned about the idea that they've outsourced to a charity certain work. The question is, like you said, is this the right charity for all kinds of reasons, with the controversies, whether or not they are physically able to deliver the services. And I think those are legitimate questions. And I think the optics are terrible. I think Trudeau should have known better. I think, the fact that Sophie Gregoire Trudeau does the podcast is one of those things that should make you go, we'd love to help you out, but I don't think we can. You could be one of a couple of groups, but we're going to spread it around. I think the perception of being close, I don't think it's a conflict, but I think the perception of the Trudeaus being close is just one of those things. Yeah,
it's real politics means that you've got to consider all factors. If you want this program to be successful, then you don't create a situation whereby it can be derailed and can predictably be derailed by your closeness. Now, I don't have a problem with our prime minister and his wife having close ties to a major charity, a charity that is not corrupt, a charity that has been, you know, audited and only spends 9 cents of every dollar on administration, which is low for charities. I think it's actually good that we have a prime minister who is close to someone like the Aga Khan, which does charitable work. His organization does charitable work, that knows the Kielbergers and their organization and supports them in their charitable work. I think it's great that we have a leader that is connected to people like that, who provides services for people. I think it's terrific. But I think you also have to recognize, okay, the relationship shouldn't preclude we from being eligible to apply for the money, but it should also, the reality is, it also creates a greater sense of focus, and we need clarity more so than we would with any other organization.
Yeah, you better be damn careful when you're dealing with them. I mean, you got to do twice as much diligence and transparency when you're dealing with someone who's close to you, because, you know, as my late friend Senator Keith Davey used to love to say, perception is reality in politics. And the perception is, if someone is getting it because they're on the inside track or a personal relationship, then you've got to be way more careful than just if it's someone down the street you're given a grant.
Yeah, so I think that as much as a lot of press has laid not the death of this program, but certainly it's going to be a later implemented program at the feet of the Conservatives, I think my feeling is that it's actually the fault of the Trudeau government for not recognizing that this was a hot potato, for not having the facts available to answer all the rational, reasonable questions that were going to be asked. I mean, just the fact that they backed away from it. If there's nothing to be concerned about, why back away? Why not push through? You know, Conservatives would have pushed through and not given any oxygen to the story. They wouldn't even have responded. That's the way Conservatives have been acting. I mean, I first noticed it, especially with the George W. Bush administration. If you simply refuse to answer questions on a topic, the media moves on because they can't get anything for it. They can't get any movement. So if there's nothing to see here, then just push forward, just continue doing it. I think that them not prepping enough in advance for what was a predictable response by the Conservatives, for them not having the answers, even now, as I understand it, they still don't have the answers for us about those questions. And those answers should have been front and center and ready in a briefing book before this was announced. And in doing that and then backing away from it, so meaning that the program is going to be delayed further, I think the Trudeau government blew it here.
Yep, absolutely. And I think too, and this is, you know, people will go on and on about, you know, me being a Justin lover and all the rest of this stuff. But, you know, I will say that this really looks like a rookie mistake. And the Trudeau government, both, you know, before the last election and the new minority government, seems to keep falling into these rookie mistakes that, you know, where they're either in a bubble or they just can't see just how something is going to play. Because, I can picture Trudeau saying, you know, I've worked with these people, they're great people, everyone must love them the same way I do. What's not to love? You've got Kielberger getting starting this charity at 12 years old, being the second youngest person to get the Order of Canada because of all of this. They do such great work. He's just sort of blinded to it and thought, well, everyone is going to love this. This is so great. And not getting a sense of what's out there, you know, whether it is, you know, questions about, people are always, you know, fast to pop up their head and say, well, you know, I got fired from these people, or they got a problem with diversity on their board, or the Kielbergers are really high-handed, or it's a cult of personality. There's all kinds of, whether any of it is justified or not, there's controversy out there about it. And some people are just blind to the controversy about it because they just don't see it. I mean, you know, the Aga Khan thing would be, you know, another thing. It's like, well, Aga Khan was a pallbearer at Pierre Trudeau's funeral. So no one's going to have any problem with me going and using his resort because it's just friends. It's like, you know, it doesn't work that way. And these are sort of rookie perception mistakes that if anything, I think the Trudeau government just kind of stumbles, you know, from every once in a while into one of these things and then flails around like it's quicksand.
Well, I mean, I would offer that the SNC-Lavalin affair was a rookie mistake.
I don't think it was.
I don't think it was corruption. It was a PMO that didn't listen to the prime minister or was so ham-handed in the way they went about it. But they didn't even realize that they could be seen as violating the law. They were not connected to the prime minister. They didn't tell the prime minister what they were doing, and their methods certainly could give rise to and did give rise to notions that they were trying to pressure the justice minister into, you know, taking a plea for SNC-Lavalin.
Yeah.
And that there was really no deep, even in the ethics commissioner's report, there was really no deep corruption there. There was no quid pro quo. There was no money being transferred from one place to another. No cash in an envelope. There was nothing there. It was just simply really ham-handed approach to governing. And yeah. it was a rookie mistake. And I'm more willing to forgive rookie mistakes in the first term of a government than I am at this point in time.
Yeah, and you know, and I think SNC-Lavalin, and I think this one with we as well is a real failure to read the room. You know, in the case of SNC-Lavalin, reading the room was, you know, partially reading Jody Wilson-Raybould as a person and seeing, you know, what's important to her and how she's going to react, and then not reading the room in terms of, well, you know, this is just a technical legal thing. No one's really going to care about it. That, you know, those were mistakes. And I think the wee thing was failure to read the room, how this was going to be regarded, because I really think that the Trudeau government felt that this was going to be heralded as a really good thing. We've got this Made in Canada world-class charity, and they're going to roll it out really quickly, and it's money for students who need it, and who's not going to like this? Well, it turns out a lot of people didn't like it. And, you know, that's, I don't know if that's living in a bubble or that's just, again, not being able to see what everyone else sees right in front of them.
Yeah. And I think that something that I haven't seen mentioned too much is the truth about this program is it's workfare. You know,
that's the other problem too. It's $1,000 per 100 hours, but you have to work you have to volunteer for 100 hours before you qualify for. So if you for your $1,000 grant. So if you work 150 hours, you still only get your $1,000. And then there is this scheme that I, you know, I thought was kind of crazy, where there is sort of a bounty for, you know, the people are compensated who recruit and place these students based on the number of students they have. It started getting a kind of an Amway feel to it. And there's ways of incentive, you know, people have bonuses and structures and goals and all that kind of stuff in business, and you know, I can understand how that you know might be a way of compensating people, but it just didn't play very well. So the whole thing just and you know, when you figure out, well, if it's $1,000 grant for volunteering, and you know, of course, volunteering is supposed to be free. This isn't salary. This isn't paid. But at the end of your 100 hours, you get $1,000 grant. So it isn't $10 an hour, which would be well below what minimum wage pretty much everywhere in Canada. But you know, it was meant to be sort of a tip at the end of this. So it's, you know, there are
problematic aspects. Like,
oh yeah, absolutely. Just the
I
way
just don't
structured.
Like the work. In this case, I don't mind the workfare idea. I don't mind that, but to call it volunteering when you're doing it for pay is kind of a misnomer. But I don't exactly know what the term actually is, because you can't call it paid work either, because as you pointed out, there's no per hour figure that is attributed to it. So it's, you know, it's troubling in some ways. But I mean, it's the government trying to do right. I see where their heart is in this. I think if they were to just give the money out, there would be hell to pay, but they're saying, no, they're going to be working for it. They're going to be earning it. Okay. I get that too. But just something about it being workfare, which is, you know, for those who don't know, workfare is something in the United States where welfare recipients have to work a certain number of hours in order to get their welfare. And it doesn't matter what kind of work, you know, volunteer work, public works work, something, in order to get their welfare money, even though some of them aren't capable, aren't mobile or, you know, are capable of doing it.
You think the conservatives would love that, because that was one of the planks of Mike Harris when his Common Sense Revolution 25 years ago was workfare. It was imported from the States as being this great idea that people get pride out of work and all the rest. And, you know, you don't get benefits unless you're contributing.
Yeah.
But, but students already have. Summer students have the summer student program, sort of the sister program to CERB, that, you know, I think it's $1,250 a month over the 3 months of the summer for students who would otherwise have been able to get a summer job and, you know, help pay for their tuition in the fall or, you know, just, you know, be busy. So the government already has a program for people who are out of work. But, you know, and this one, again, I'm not quite sure. It just seems like the whole thing was a fuzzy plan to begin with that was going to make people feel good. But, you know, a lot of people are saying, well, you know, you're going to add almost $1 billion if this thing is really, really successful to the budget. So, you know, maybe you should have done more than sitting on the back of a napkin and figure this thing out.
Yeah. They blew it on this, and they've got really nobody to blame but themselves, because you can't blame the opposition. Is opportunistic, and if you give them something that has a target as broad as the side of a barn, then they're going to shoot at it. And you really need to make something really tight and neat when you're going to be presenting something that's going to cost this much money. And they didn't. They didn't take the proper care. They didn't think properly about it. I believe that Justin Trudeau wasn't the person. I mean, you know, the civil service, they go through their own process to do this. The prime minister does not have hands on in, you know, where every dollar is spent. That's just absurd. So I believe that he probably didn't know, but I'm sure he didn't object when he saw that, you know, which organization it was, because he knows they do good work.
Yeah. And it's a big program. So, you know, you've got to think it comes to his attention in a pretty detailed way.
Yeah. And they just blew it. And the people who are poorer for it are the students. Hopefully they will get this thing up and running fast enough that students can take advantage of it before the summer is absolutely gone. I'm doubtful.
Yeah, I'm doubtful too. I think it's going to be at best a patchwork rollout that's going to be too little too late at this point.
And it's going to leave them open to criticism for that as well. So on multiple fronts, the government blew it on this. And it's time. I don't know who's doing the advising on with the prime minister and with the government. I don't know who is doing some sort of oversight, who's the person who is able to look at stuff from an arm's length point of view and see where the weaknesses are. And I don't know if there's anybody doing that, but it appears to me that whoever's doing it perhaps is overtaxed and is missing things, and or perhaps there's nobody who is really able to look, to step outside themselves and look from the outside in as to what something is going to look like and what the potential pitfalls are, because they're blundering into things like this. I mean, the prime minister has high marks, I think, for good reason, for the way he's handled, he and his government have handled the COVID situation. Maybe they got a little bit cocky because they're rising in the polls, and people, even people who are of other political stripes, have said, well, I don't like Trudeau, but they've done a good job with the COVID situation. Maybe they got a little bit cocky and said, well, yeah, there's some potential rough edges here, but we should be able to you know, ride it out.
Yep.
And then they didn't decide to ride it out. They just bailed. You know, it just doesn't look good when you say nothing's wrong here, but we're going to bail anyway because it doesn't look good.
Yeah.
That doesn't look good either.
Yeah. The breakup was mutual. Yeah.
It's, yeah. Yeah.
All no right. No one ever believes that.
Yeah. It's not you. It's me. So interesting things to talk about. Again, you know, I thank God that that's the kind of scandal we have here in Canada. You know,
money we didn't spend on a program that was supposed to help people with the charity, but you know, we just picked the wrong venue for it.
Yeah, it's, you know, this is a great Canadian scandal in the sense that it's about a bungled attempt to help people.
Yeah, it's and it all comes unraveled because the prime minister's wife does a free podcast.
Yeah, it's like, oh, you know, okay. very you know, I'm glad that Canada is really bad at scandals. And I'm glad, quite frankly, I'm glad that we're not so enmeshed in so many scandals that something like this would be pushed to the bottom. I'm glad that we still care about things like this.
Yep. Well, and the Conservatives are pushing for a full parliamentary budget officer or the ethics commissioner to do an investigation on how this decision was made and all the rest. We'll see. You know, I think it depends on whether or not the Bloc votes in favor of it, whether this ever sees the light of day. But like I say, they're champing for a scandal they can get their teeth into, because God knows they're languishing way, way, way down everywhere except for Alberta. In Saskatchewan, they are in the dumpsters in the rest of Canada in terms of popularity. So, you know, they're fighting like alley cats, because they need something to get their teeth into.
Yeah. And well, we'll see. I mean, I still would like to know the answers to those questions about how this was arrived at. And maybe we will see that. And maybe we'll find that there was smoke, but no fire. We'll see. That's something we may talk about in future episodes, but I think this wraps up this one for us. So, Stephen, thank you very much. You can be found at Stephen Lawtens on Twitter, StephenLautens. And you can find me at Stephen with a V, Stephen J. Kersner on Twitter. I encourage you to follow Stephen's Twitter. It's informative and funny at the same time.
So a lot to live up to. I appreciate it.
Well, you do it every day. So thank you, everybody, for listening. And again, I don't believe that you don't have $1.25 a week that you can submit to help us keep building this network and keep it going and growing. $1.25 a week, which is $5 a month. Come on, you know that you got that money. you spend it on a coffee on, you know, once, twice, three times a day. You can certainly spend the $5 to help us keep going, because, and I hate to have to ring this bell all the time, but you know, Ezra Levant and his Rebel keep getting funded to the, last time I saw, they were over $1 million a year. In funds.
You know, your problem is our listeners are way too smart. It's easy to separate a dumb person from their money, but you know, we're asking smart people to actually pony up, which is, you know, a little bit of a harder ask sometimes.
Well, it is, because it's easy to tell dumb people that they're coming to get you. They're coming to get your guns.
Well, maybe we should tell people we're coming to get them.
Well, the truth is that
it's like 4 o'clock good for you.
I'll honk twice. The truth is that the segment of the population that is being marginalized as far as having their voices heard, having their questions asked and answered, is the middle. People in the center right, center left, centrists, the people in the middle where most of Canada sits. We're being shouted out by the far left and by the far right. Those two are clashing with each other, and the more reasonable discussions that need to happen, the kind that actually lead to solutions and lead to conversations and dialogues between opposing views, those things are being eclipsed by the clash of the titans on the right and the left. So truthfully, the right isn't under any fearing being marginalized. Their voice is loud and proud, and the left, which is a spectrum of voices, they're loud and proud too. But those of us who want to have conversations that take issues, look at them from a reasonable point of view, not a doctrinaire point of view, who want to understand issues in a way that isn't using jargon or keywords or slogans, we're the ones who are being shouted out. We're the ones who are being marginalized and being eclipsed. And that's what we're trying to do here, is raise the voice for those of us who are centrists, who are people who can see both sides of an issue, who lean one way but can understand the other side, who can understand how to have a dialogue, or who are looking for a dialogue that discusses issues that isn't people screaming at each other. That's what we're doing here. So if you'd like to help us out, we'd appreciate it. You can become a monthly patron, and people are jumping on now. You can become a monthly patron by going to Patreon. It's Patreon, patreon.com/FUNetworkTV. If you want to give a one-time donation, that's appreciated as well at PayPal, which is directed to our email address, FUNetworkTV@gmail.com. Okay, Stephen, thank you.
Yeah, well, keep cool, and look forward to talking again next week.
Okay, and thank you guys for listening. This has been Stephen and Stephen on Fun, the FU Network.